crowd at this distinguished place in London. It's an honour today to be here. I think Roger has just arrived to introduce Roger Waters. As well as making brilliant music, Roger has been speaking out for the rights of men and women for many years, and I thank him warmly for initiating this extraordinary event to celebrate and defend Julian Assange. Roger regards Julian as a hero, and so do I. And it'll be a pleasure to introduce Julian's brother, Gabriel, who is here from Melbourne. Gabriel went with me recently to visit Julian in Belmarsh Prison and was deeply moved by the treatment of his brother. Behind us here, of course, is the Home Office, the polite name for Britain's Interior Ministry. The behaviour of the British government towards Julian Assange is a disgrace. A profanity on the very notion of human rights. It's no exaggeration to say that the treatment and persecution of Julian Assange is the way dictatorships treat a political prisoner. There is one reason for this. Julian and WikiLeaks have performed an historic public service by giving millions of people facts on why and how their governments deceive them secretly and often illegally, why they invade countries, why they spy on us. Julian is singled out for special treatment for one reason only. He is a truth teller. His case is meant to send a warning to every journalist and every publisher, the kind of warning that has no place in a democracy. I spoke to Julian at the weekend. He'd been just allowed to have his first proper exercise. He was allowed to pace up and down in a small bitumen yard. However, at Belmarsh Prison, they have a sense of humour. On the walls facing the so-called exercise yard are happy clappy words about the blades of grass beneath your feet. But there's no grass. Julian is locked up for more than 21 hours, sometimes longer. It's four months since he was dragged out of the Ecuadorian embassy, literally, in brutal contravention of international law. It's 4 months, and he is still denied the documents and the basic tools to prepare his case against an outrageous demand for his extradition to the United States, where he faces incarceration and almost certainly torture. And yet, he is not allowed today to call his American lawyers. He is not allowed access to vital documents. He is not allowed access to a computer. He is confined in a single cell in the hospital wing, where he is isolated most of the time from other people. All this because he infringed a bail order, the merest of offences, and he sought political asylum from the threat to his life that awaited him in Trump's America. When I asked Julian what he'd like me to say today, he was adamant. Say it's not just me. It's much wider. It's all of us. It's all journalists and all publishers who do their job who are in danger. In other words, the danger Julian Assange faces can easily spread to the present and past editors of The Guardian, The New York Times, Der Spiegel, El País in Spain, The Sydney Morning Herald, and many other newspapers and media outlets around the world that publish the WikiLeaks revelations about the lies and crimes of our governments. Never before in my career as a journalist have I known such an attack on our most basic freedom to publish and to know. The message is loud and clear. Be careful, or you too will end up in an American hellhole. Journalism is not a crime in the United States, not yet. But if Julian is extradited and convicted, it will become a crime. Journalism that does its job and tells people what governments do behind their backs in their name. Julian is not an American. He is an Australian citizen. WikiLeaks, which he founded, is not a US-based publication. But the meaning of his extradition could not be clearer. No matter who you are or where you are, if you expose the crimes of government, you will be hunted down, kidnapped, and sent to the US as a spy. 17 out of the 18 charges that Julian faces in America relate to the routine work of an investigative journalist, which is protected under the First Amendment of the US Constitution. The 18th charge about hacking doesn't even relate to him, and even the prosecution over there say that. The whole thing is a sham. The US prosecutors know it's a sham. A federal judge recently declared, effectively, it's a sham. The British government know it's a sham. The Australian government knows it's a sham. That's why Julian is locked up more than 21 hours a day in a maximum security prison and treated worse than a murderer. Why is that? Why is he not protected by international law, as the United Nations Working Party has demanded? He is to be made an example, that's why. What happens to Julian Assange and to Chelsea Manning is meant to intimidate us, to frighten us into silence. And the moment that we fall silent, it's over. By defending Julian Assange, we defend our most sacred rights. Speak up now, or wake up one morning to the silence of a new kind of tyranny. The choice is ours. Thank you. Just before I introduce Gabriel, I'd like to say that on the 28th of September at 2 o'clock outside Belmarsh Prison, there'll be a demonstration by Julian's Defence Committee supporters. So now I'd like to introduce Julian's brother, Gabriel.
Hello, I'm Gabriel Shipton, Julian's brother. Last month, I went to visit my brother Julian in Belmarsh Prison. It had been a year since I had seen him last. I hugged him and he told me this place he was in was hell. I instantly understood what he meant. A yellow inmate's armband wound tightly around his arm exposed how emaciated he had become underneath his baggy prison clothes. In his eyes and voice were the signs that this hell was working its hardest at crushing any hope he had left. This visit, we didn't laugh. There was nothing to laugh about. I held back tears as I realised this could be one of the last times I see him. Afterwards, my daughter wanted to know why her uncle was locked up. "Has he done something bad, Dad?" she asked. I struggled to explain in a way a five-year-old could understand. As Julian's brother, and on behalf of his children, other brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews, mother and father, I call on the UK Home Secretary to block extradition to the USA. Thank you.
Now I'd like to introduce the man who started this extraordinary demonstration here today, and it is an extraordinary demonstration. It was his idea, and when I told Julian that this was going to happen, I think it cheered him more than any news he's had for a very, very long time. He's a huge fan of Roger's, and to know that Roger is going to pay this tribute to him personally gives him the kind of strength that he needs. And I hope Roger understands the fantastic thing he's done just in giving Julian that support. So without talking anymore, here's Roger Waters.
Wow. 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 John and I go back a long way. I haven't got any notes, so I'm prepared to stand here and be emotional and mumble if necessary, because to see all you people here today is deeply, deeply moving. Julian Assange is locked up for 23 hours a day. And when John was talking about it just now, I was thinking that what I need to help to persuade people is that we as individuals need to be able to put ourselves in the position of somebody who is in solitary confinement. I've been to one or two events like this, except they weren't a lot of people like this is. It was Andy Worthington and his dog listening to me when I was demonstrating for the release of Shaka Alma from Guantanamo a few years ago. Thank goodness he was eventually released and is now back with his family. Where was I? How do we put ourselves in the position of a Julian Assange in solitary confinement, or with that kid in Syria or Palestine or Rohingya being blown to bits by these people in this building here? How do we put ourselves in the position of the parents of that child who will spend the rest of his life on crutches or however? It's called empathy, and it is the most valuable thing that any human being can possess in their lives. And the reason that it's so valuable to all of you here, me, John, everybody involved in any of these movements, is because it brings us joy. It is what brings joy to our lives, to be able to empathize not just with Julian Assange or the dead kid in Palestine, but with all our brothers and sisters all over the world when we acknowledge that we are brothers and sisters and that we all have a responsibility one to another. All right. So, one of the reasons that it's so moving to see you all here is because it means that nobody standing in Marsham Street today, with the possible exception of Special Branch, I know you're there, none of you are asleep. You are awake. You understand your predicament and the predicament of the other 65 million people who live in Great Britain. Well, no, it was never great. It was a lot better than it is now. When I was last here, my old lady was out and shopping, and she bought a toy for our dog to destroy. It's called a pet hay. I know this because there's a lady in somewhere in this great metropolis who makes, it's a little toy, and this one was Boris Johnson. We have him now. I mean, what's left of him. I'm happy to say the Chihuahua has almost entirely destroyed Bojo, as we call him. And we're happy to see that. So when I was making one of my little videos in support of the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela. I made, there's a chap there with a bad throat. Somebody give him a strepsil. Anyway, I made a reference to Donald Trump. Well, the Bojo pet hate looks a bit like Trump. It's got that weird, funny hair and everything that they share. The lady said, "I'm just making a Trump. Would you like one?" And I said, "Yes, please." She sent it as an email to me. So we now have two. And she's one woman working on her own. And these are her only two pet hates so far. Let's turn it into one of the greatest corporations in the world. Pet hates. The first two are Bojo and Trump. Anyway, I digress. What else do I have to say? John Pilger and I go back to 1985 when I worked with him and with a lovely man called David Munro, who was a filmmaker, and they had made a documentary film in 1985 or before called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, or just The Four Horsemen. It was based on the idea, and I to this day remember a line from the film because I used it in a show I did called Radio Chaos, and the show was, "We are fueling wars," and we are. And this is what Julian understood, i.e. because we want to make money. I know you all know this. I'm really talking to some of the people that sleep at home. Oi, wake up! You all know this, but we make weapons in order to make money. Not for us, but for them. And in order to sell the weapons, we need to encourage people to kill one another and to be fighting. Well, as we all know now, in the desperate predicament that this tiny, fragile planet is in, we are going to have to learn to act collectively. I know this is boring, but it's fucking true. So we're going to have to learn to act collectively, to express our love for one another, and in consequence, hopefully, the planet will survive for another 100 or 200 or 300 or 1,000 or 10,000 years, and our children and grandchildren can experience some measure of the joy that is to be found in the love of one another. And that's all I have to say. Thank you. Good man.
Thank you.
I'm Roger. Right on the wall. Which one's big?
We're going to sing a song in a minute. But before we do, since we're here and it's not pissing with rain, where are we going to go next? I don't know. I've got very little to do. I'm going to tell you a story because I love it. All right, here it goes. No more preamble. I had a friend who was a junior minister in the Thatcher government, and one of his jobs was to go and meet dignitaries at Heathrow Airport. And one day, this is his story, by the way. You'd know him if I mentioned his name, but I won't, because... Anyway, President Gorbachev was going to pass through London refueling his plane. So this young chap had to go with a bunch of other young guys from the Foreign Office and the Civil Service to bow and scrape in their morning suits. Anyway, Gorbachev lands and all these Russian troops and blah, blah, blah. And he's only there for 20 minutes and they're in a little room. He's there with an aide, and these chaps are all standing around in their shiny brogues and their pinstripes and their morning coats and whatever. I say, jolly good, this should be jolly interesting. And Gorbachev just stands there and looks at him like he did. And eventually he leans over to his aide and he goes, and the aide says, President Gorbachev would like to ask you a question. And all the young blokes go, I say, bloody good, jolly good, this should be interesting. So he goes, so the aide says, President Gorbachev would like to know your opinion on the following question. What do you think would have been different in world history if President Khrushchev was assassinated rather than President Kennedy? And they all go, fuck me. This is too difficult. So now they're staring at their brogues and shuffling backwards towards the wall. So he, Gorbachev, to his eternal credit, let them stew in it for several minutes. And then he turns to his... And he didn't, never cracked a smile, blah, blah, blah. And he says to his aide, And the aide says, President Gorbachev believes it unlikely that that Mr. Onassis would have married Mrs. Khrushchev. I fucked it up, but... I kind of like that story. And so I may be going to see the great man at the beginning of November because he's getting very old now and we owe him, President Gorbachev, late of the USSR, an enormous debt of gratitude for understanding some of the things that we're sharing here together in this meeting outside our dilapidated, miscreant, Home Office. All right, I will shut up now and we'll sing this song. I'd like you to welcome to the stage a very old friend of mine, Andy Fairweather Lowe. That needs to be over there. We're a bit further over. That's all right. That's fine. That's lovely. Yeah, just leave it like that. It'll be fine. It's only rock and roll. You know what this is? What this is here today, just thinking about this song, what I wrote, Ernie Wise, it doesn't matter. It's a walk-on part in the war. The people often ask me about this song. Oh, what does it mean? What does it mean? Well, that little bit of the song, would you exchange a walk-on part in the war for a lead role in a cage? Well, no, I wouldn't. This is my walk-on part in this war, and I would much prefer to be here with all of you who are also making a walk-on part in the war rather than accepting a lead role in a cage. What?
Guitar. I need some guitar because I have no... And you need guitar.
Yeah, we need to hear Andy's guitar.
Well, it might be just better to strum.
The first time I played an acoustic guitar in public in front of an audience that hadn't bought tickets was at my kids', one of my kids', schools. He was 8 years old then. He's 43 now. But I was so fucking frightened going to play to these eight-year-olds. I promise. This is a measure of how our insecurities can well up and make life difficult. Though I had to take Andy Fairlow with me to play the guitar and as moral and musical support. So I'm very glad that I haven't moved away from those basic needs. And it's great to have you here, Andy. Thank you. You're a lovely man and a great friend. All right, here we go. Can you hear him now? Can you hear his... All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Julian Assange, we are with you. Free Julian Assange! That's it. I'm done. Thank you all so much. From the bottom of my heart, thank you, John Pilger. This is really very, very, very moving moment for me, so thank you.
Follow me. Hold on,